Under Ice, the Flowers, written by Susie Carter, read by Silvercat 1620. Summary. Clark had already liked wearing the black suit a little too much. The black suit. The black cape. Notes. For Linda Cheer. Translation available in Russian. Link in the original fic. I have had varying amounts of a treat written for you since last round, Lind, so I have no idea why I set the whole thing aside this round and wrote this instead. The heart wants what it wants, and apparently this round that is Kryptonian cape marriage customs, because that discussion elsewhere was tremendously fun. And I couldn't help myself when I saw you'd actually prompted for it. ETA, which, for anybody who knows as little about Game of Thrones as I do, that's where the fundamental idea of exchanging one's house cloak slash cape for another's at marriage came from. I know nothing about Game of Thrones and made up the rest by extrapolating from that starting point. Title borrowed from Cloakless by Ruth Baldwin Pearson, because the title fits the cape thing and the content fits the hypothermia and pining, and come on, I had to. I made up absolutely all the Kryptonian specifics of the self-indulgent world-building nonsense in here. I'm sorry, slash, you're welcome. Professor Ivo and a robot capable of absorbing slash using the JL's powers against them are borrowed from comics, but I made up this pseudo-kryptonite, unless that's actually also in comics somewhere and I just forgot about it. And you definitely do not need to know anything else about him. He's just here to hurt Clark. Good job, Professor Ivo. Clark had already liked wearing the black suit a little too much. The black suit. The black cape. It hadn't started out that way. The day he'd come back, the day he'd put it on, it had felt right to do it. But it had felt right because it was an acknowledgement and even a kind of warning. He wasn't the same person he'd been before he died. He couldn't be, no matter how badly he wished he were. And he hadn't wanted to seem as though he were pretending to be, as though he were trying to fool anyone into believing that he was. But after a while, he got better. He got used to being alive again, and he felt less like a stranger to himself. And the less he needed to wear the black suit the way he once had, the more he discovered he wanted to wear it. He felt ridiculous. Ridiculous and incredibly obvious. It was so simplistic, and it had nothing to do with anything that mattered, wasn't actually bringing him closer to Bruce in any meaningful way. He saw Bruce all the time, fought alongside him and talked to him. That was 100 times more important than whether their uniforms matched, for crying out loud. But black was Bruce's color. Batman's. And Clark had come back from the dead, and gone and gotten himself a suit in it. Superman's pattern, Batman's colors. When he thought about it like that, it felt so unbelievably transparent that he couldn't believe Bruce hadn't called him on it yet. It was one thing to feel the way he'd started to feel about Bruce. Bruce probably wouldn't hold it against him, would be content to never speak of it, to simply ignore it. But Clark had cleverly made that impossible by blazoning it across his chest like a neon sign. Maybe Bruce hadn't figured him out yet, somehow, or maybe he was just giving Clark too much credit, assuming even he couldn't possibly have judgment that excruciatingly bad. One way or another, he hadn't said anything, and Clark couldn't talk himself into stopping. It felt good. It felt right. Bruce was the one who'd brought him back, clawed him free of death itself. Didn't that make him Bruce's, even just a little bit? He liked to think it did. He liked to pretend it did, at least. And the black suit made it easy. The black suit made it almost real. But he didn't know it actually meant anything until he ran across one particular reference in the scout ship's database. He'd been going through its archives for months and months, ever since he'd come back, one entry at a time. On the one hand, he figured it had to be a good idea. The ship had known about Steppenwolf, about the boxes. If there was anything else in there that was even half as important, he wanted to find out about it before Lex Luthor did it instead of afterward this time. And on the other hand, he liked it. It was nice, taking the time for it, going to sit and listen to the ship and letting its calm, steady voice fill his ears. The actual information was fascinating, too. The ship had been frozen in the Arctic ice for 20,000 years. The Krypton that it knew had been gone even longer than the Krypton Clark had never seen. But it remembered, and it could tell him, bring that ancient, distant world and all its long-dead people to life again for an hour at a time. He didn't always understand everything it said. There were cultural references he couldn't parse, stories, epic poems that made allusions to each other in ways he couldn't understand until he painstakingly made himself familiar with a few dozen of them, one at a time. But it would explain to him as best it could when he asked it the right questions. And sometimes it was a matter of vocabulary. The dictionary it had constructed for itself so it could speak to him in English was comprehensive, and 98% of the entries it had cataloged were correct. But sometimes it had heard a word wrong, integrated an incorrect definition into its lexicon. At first, he'd figured that was what had happened, when, in the middle of telling about him about High Queen Zara Junul and the favored concubine who had become her wife, it said, "And Shaya Martev accepted the cape of her queen's house and..." "What?" Clark said, frowning. The ship paused. "Clarify, query," it said after a moment. "The cape of her queen's house. What does that mean? You're not talking about an actual cape, are you? The piece of clothing?" "She accepted a length of cloth, typically attaching at the shoulders and extending to the knees, ankles, or floor, bearing the emblem of the royal house of Ul." "Okay, so it had been talking about an actual cape." Clark's gut lurched a little. "And that means something to Kryptonians?"
"For 100,000 years," the ship agreed placidly. "Desire or reciprocal willingness to bond in a manner functionally analogous to marriage on this world was expressed by Kryptonians through the offer, acceptance, or mimicry of one another's house colors and emblems, most typically in a cape." Clark sat there and stared at the wall without seeing it. His ears felt hot. "The offer or acceptance," he repeated blankly. "You mean someone would offer someone else a cape in their house colors or with their house emblem if they wanted to marry them?" "Correct. And if whoever they'd offered it to took it and put it on, then they'd given their agreement." "Correct." And... his throat felt tight. His mouth was dry. He swallowed. It didn't really help. "And mimicry, as in making yourself a cape that looked like someone else's colors or symbol, made it look like you were, meant that you were open to it, inviting them to consider you, saying you'd accept if you got the offer."
"Correct," the ship agreed.
"Oh," he thought distantly. "Oh. Well, that was
a hell of a coincidence, wasn't it?" That was all it was, obviously. Sure, all right, maybe if Kryptonians from 20,000 years ago happened to spot him standing next to Bruce in the black suit, the black cape, the thick, enveloping length of it that was so much like Batman's, they'd think things. But it wasn't like he'd done it on purpose. Not really. He hadn't even known until just now. It had been months since he'd picked out the black suit. At the time, that wasn't why he'd done it. And he really did not need to go down the rabbit hole of why exactly the ship had had it fabricated, ready to offer it to him as an option. No, it couldn't have known, when he hadn't even known himself. It was a coincidence. The overlap between his post-resurrection trauma and a quirk of ancient Kryptonian culture, even if it was a quirk that had apparently lasted at least 100,000 years.
He hadn't been raised Kryptonian, and Bruce certainly had no idea that by alien standards of a dead world, Clark had been leaving ring catalogs lying around for almost a year. It was a coincidence, and it was irrelevant, and there was no reason for him to give it a second thought.
But he did. A second thought, a third, a fourth, a 15th, a 40th, a 100th. He couldn't stop. In a weird, stupid way, it was gratifying, validating. It did mean what he'd sometimes felt like it meant, that he was this way about Bruce, that he was wearing the black suit. Or at least it had meant something once to someone. Not much, maybe, but it was more than he thought he'd had. It was a gift.
It was a comfort, too. That there was some kind of metric by which he'd offered himself to Bruce, by which Bruce, at least, hadn't technically rejected him, even if he also hadn't accepted. Clark had gotten into the weeds about it with the ship for a couple of hours. Over time, the system had gotten increasingly complicated with all of the different kinds of ways to signal permission, a lack of refusal that didn't constitute commitment either. Bruce hadn't told him to get rid of the suit. Asked him why he was wearing it, a pointed pretense of ignorance that would have been considered unmistakable, nor kindly but firmly implied to him that his own colors looked better on him, that it would be to his benefit to switch back. If Bruce had said he looked good in the black, that he should wear it forever, that would have been... But never mind. He didn't know why he was so stuck on it. Why it mattered so much to him. Maybe it was a Kryptonian thing, biological, not his fault, not something he could control. An instinct, an imperative that made him want so badly to belong to someone, to be acknowledged as belonging to someone, that he'd act out like this for himself, even when no one else knew he was doing it. That he'd break the way he broke in his dreams when he didn't have that, when it was taken from him, gone, lost, and he knelt there with nothing, and a huge hand settled its anchoring weight on his shoulder and took him from himself, too. The point was, now that he knew, he couldn't unknow it. He couldn't forget it. He liked it in a secret, guilty, selfish way, and it comforted him. And no matter how stupid he felt for dwelling on it, it wasn't actually hurting anything. Bruce had saved him. Bruce had brought him back to life, fought to have him back and to keep him. That meant something, even without the cape. And if he wanted to have the cape too, just for himself, then what difference did it make? It didn't change anything. It didn't matter to anyone but him. He could work with Bruce, talk to Bruce, spend time around Bruce, and act the same way he always had. It wasn't an issue. And that stayed true for another couple of months, until the day he almost froze himself to death. It wasn't a big deal, at least not by his current standards. A scientist, a robot, a lab-grown crystallized mineral that mimicked the effects of kryptonite a little too well. The robot had been enhanced with something. Absorptive nanocells. The scientist had been shouting about it while the robot was attacking Clark, but Clark had been a bit too busy to really take it in. And the scientist also had a debilitating terror of death, which was why he'd wanted to capture Superman with his robot in the first place, to study him, unlock the mysteries of his Kryptonian physiology, and live forever on nothing but sunlight. Clark had managed to lure the robot away from downtown Metropolis to make sure the collateral damage was limited. But that was about the best he could do. The robot could absorb any power Clark used on it and then use it on him in return. And as a bonus, it shot pseudo-kryptonite bullets. The 10th or 11th time it hammered him into the pavement, he couldn't get up again. Then it stalked up to him and shot him in the face, and he was gone, under. He remembered the cold. The bright ice, the brilliant, relentless white. He remembered wondering dimly whether this was the Arctic or the Antarctic, whether there was anywhere near where he'd found the scout ship, what felt like half a lifetime ago. and had technically been a whole lifetime ago, or at least one hell of an intermission. The suit was cut off him. He was bolted to a table. A handful of incisions had already been cut, neat, bloody lines carved into him by the time that the League arrived. They had the numbers to deal with the robot, a lot better than Clark had been able to do on his own. But there were some explosions first. Explosions and Victor, steady and serious, breaking the restraints one by one and helping him off the table, and then forced to push him down, duck, roll away. He didn't know what it was that had made him decide it was a good idea to try and get out by himself. He just needed to. The table had been studded with pseudo-kryptonite, and he wanted to get away from it. More than anything. It was possible he hadn't been thinking all that clearly. He'd crawled out into the snow through the wreckage of one wall of the secret lab while the League was still busy with the fight. And about 20 minutes later, Bruce found him. He had to get away. He had to get further away. He was pretty sure he told Bruce that 10 or 15 times, panicking, in agony. Bruce got an arm under him, around him, and helped him stagger another 20 or 30 strides. He felt more able to think with every step, even if he'd also never been so cold in his life. It always took a little time for the effects of kryptonite to wear off, and apparently that was also true of pseudo-kryptonite. And then, when Bruce decided they had to be far enough, he'd made Clark stop. And he held Clark up with one hand and reached with the other for his own shoulders, one and then the other, and came away with his own cape. The sensation of it closing around him, the sweep of the thick synthetic fabric around against his skin, jerked Clark back to clarity. Bruce was wrapping him in it, out to its full width, and tucking it with focused, efficient precision around his bare body. It was practical. It was just practical. It was all he had, and Clark was still much too cold. Bruce had probably designed the cape with 1,000 possible disasters in mind, including this one. No doubt it contained a thermal layer, lofted, insulating weave, and could keep Bruce alive in hypothermia-inducing conditions for at least 24 hours. But Jesus, Clark felt dizzy with it. This wasn't a self-indulgent pretense. Wasn't Clark putting on a black version of his own cape and allowing himself to enjoy the illusion of it? Bruce had taken this cape off his own shoulders not a minute ago, hadn't just handed it to Clark, but had put it on Clark himself. It was absolutely everything he'd wanted. Better than any elaborate fantasy of growing up on Krypton and catching the interest of Bruce of the House of Wayne, just because it was real. And at the same time, it wasn't, because Bruce didn't even know he was doing it. Bruce hadn't said a word in almost 3 minutes. Clark bit the inside of his cheek. He was still painfully cold, and Bruce's cape was warm. But he should take it off. Give it back. Jesus, he was bleeding on it. He didn't know what gave him away. He didn't think he'd moved his hands at all. Maybe his weight had shifted. Something. Bruce looked at him, Batman's cowl, Batman's voice, and said,
"Don't even think about it."
Clark croaked. "Don't," Bruce spit out. Clark curled his fingers into it a little tighter and kept it on. After it was all over, Bruce didn't leave him alone. They all flew back to Metropolis in the Fox, except Victor, who was flying back separately with Professor Ivo held in a pair of his own restraints. Once they'd arrived, Bruce bundled him off through the hangar and into the medical bay. There was heat, water, clothing in Clark's size, full-spectrum yellow sun lighting. 24 hours observation, he'd snapped, but kind of softly, and then he left Clark there to sleep. And when Clark woke up, warm and clothed and invulnerable again, he discovers his hands were still wrapped in Bruce's cape. Bruce had left it with him. Probably just because he hadn't been able to get Clark to let go of it, 3/4 of the way asleep and still disoriented. Probably because he had 10 of them, and there was no reason he should care what happened to this one in particular. Clark stood up, lifted it up where it had been trapped beneath his body, and shook it loose. It hadn't wrinkled at all.
It fell into the same familiar sweeping drape it always made when it hung from Bruce's shoulders, when he hadn't jumped off something and cued it to go hang glider stiff instead. It felt smooth, thick, a pleasantly heavy weight to it. Clark swallowed. Bruce wasn't in the medical bay, wasn't anywhere within Clark's line of sight. If Clark tried a little bit, he could hear him, past one or two walls, standing at a work table, fussing with something and letting out sharp, disapproving breaths through his nose when whatever it was didn't cooperate with him. It was fine. He wouldn't know. One more time wouldn't hurt. Clark swallowed and let his eyes fall shut and lifted the cape around himself, threw it over his shoulders. He had to hold it there with his hands. Bruce had clearly picked this particular spare set of clothing with Clark in mind, and a Henley and a plaid flannel button-down had nowhere for the cape's shoulders grips to attach correctly. He didn't mind. He drew a breath, let it out, fixed the weight and the movement, the feel of the cape into his mind with all his attention. And then he let it slide away, caught it before it could fall to the ground, and gathered it up in his hands and went to find Bruce. It had been two walls over after all. Bruce was right there, just the way Clark had pictured it in hearing him, standing over a work table, a piece of something in one hand and a tool in the other, frowning absently in concentration. He looked up when Clark came toward him, and then his gaze fell on the cape in Clark's hands, and he went still. "Here," Clark said, awkward, too loud. He cleared his throat. "Thanks. Thank you." Bruce looked at him, and then away. He set the tool down and then the gadget. There was nothing wrong with the way he moved, exactly. It made sense that he'd be careful with whatever it was he was working on. He just seemed distinctly unhurried. "It's fine," he said evenly. "You needed insulation. I had some to spare." "Yeah," Clark agreed and coughed again. His throat was just tight, that was all. He didn't mean to say it. He hadn't precisely been planning to. It was just that he hadn't expected how it would make him feel to be given Bruce's cape and then have to give it back. If he was thinking anything, it was that it would take some of the strange, crushing weight of that away and let him breathe. He'd say it, and Bruce would think it was interesting, even amusing. Clark would laugh it off too, and then it couldn't possibly keep this kind of grip on him. "Kryptonians think that kind of thing is romantic," he managed. "Weird, right? I guess they all wore capes, or at least on more formal public occasions, and if you gave your cape to someone from another house," Bruce said quietly, "you were offering them a place in yours." Clark froze. Bruce waited a perfect, precise, deliberate beat, and then raised his eyes to Clark's again. "You were," he added, "asking them whether they might not be willing to just give themselves to you, but to let you keep them." Clark couldn't think. He couldn't breathe. "How do you know that?" he heard himself say. Bruce turned back to the work table. "I've been compiling an index of the scout ship's database," he said. "Oh, Jesus. Off and on when I have a few hours for it. A couple of months ago, I had a few hours. I went to the ship, and I told it to resume from the most recently accessed part of the database." Bruce paused. "The error was mine. I should have been more precise. I should have told it to resume from the section of the database I personally had accessed the most recently." "Oh," Clark said. He felt hot, his skin too small, his tongue thick in his mouth. He'd already been far too conscious of Bruce's cape in his hands, and now he didn't even know which would be more telling, to hurl it away from him or clutch it against him, to try to laugh and fail, or to...
"Once I realized what you'd learned,"
Bruce said. I assumed you'd feel self-conscious. Redress your mistake, even if you hadn't known that was what it was when you made it. He paused again. Through the haze of apprehension, the impact of the way his heart was pounding in his chest, Clark began to understand that that was odd for Bruce. That Bruce was choosing his words very precisely, that he had moved neither towards Clark nor away, that he was straining with every inch of himself to keep his voice as controlled and neutral as it was. And then his eyes found Clark's again, and Jesus, Clark thought dimly. He'd known. He'd known just as long as Clark had known, plus or minus a handful of hours. He'd known all that time, and he hadn't set it aside or forgotten it either. Not Bruce, of all people, who had hung on to Clark hard enough to drag him back from the grave. You kept wearing it, he said, and then stopped again. And this time Clark was looking. This time Clark saw how tightly his jaw was set. Maybe it didn't mean anything to you after all. Maybe you'd decided it had no relevance to you. Culturally, you're as Kryptonian as I am, whatever your DNA might have to say about it. Maybe it didn't matter to you at all that you were in your colors, Clark said hoarsely. And at that, at last, Bruce cracked. Just a little, but it was enough. He squeezed his eyes shut. His throat worked. In my colors. He agreed, and there was a breathlessness to it. As if I'd asked. As if showing up in that cape were your answer. It was, Clark said helplessly, and he crossed the workroom with Bruce's cape in his hands and found Bruce's mouth with his own and kissed him. Bruce made an urgent, fractured sound in the back of his throat and caught Clark by the shoulders, opened up for him, let him, kept him, fingers tight in the seams of Clark's shirt, pressed as close as he could get, even after he broke away. They rested their faces together and caught their breath, kissed again and again, until the worst of the desperation had eased, until it felt possible to be gentle and thorough instead of frantic. And then Bruce let one hand drop to Clark's, closed it around the back of Clark's, and pressed Clark's fingers together more tightly still around the fabric of the cape, tangled in them, and murmured in Clark's ear, "Keep it." The end.